I was told early this morning that the PA system had a problem and it was picking up through the cable, one of the local radio stations. So if it's better than I am, go ahead and tune me out and tune them in. I deserve it. My first full year of school teaching, I, for some reason, got elected to a position on the executive committee of the Teachers Association. It just so happened that that year there was a rather fierce struggle over teachers' salaries, and I somehow got caught in the middle of it. I'll never forget the hostility of a few of what used to be called angry young teachers who felt that the board had to surrender or capitulate on virtually every issue of difference between the teachers and the school board. It finally all boiled down to a particular meeting where all of the teachers of the district gathered together and we had to vote as a group whether we would accept or reject the proposal of the school board. It was my belief that at that point that we should accept the offer because of its proximity to what we had requested. It was the feeling of a small minority that we ought to hold and stick to our guns down to the bitter and dying end and make the board eat crow. So as we came to that meeting, I somehow became the person who had to bring the issue to the floor. And I said to the chairman of that meeting, I just want you to know that when I stand, I'm going to move that we accept the offer of the board. Well, the meeting opened, and as the opportunity came for motions to be placed on the floor, several people jumped to their feet as though like a Youth for Christ Bible quiz, the first guy off his chair got the floor. I more deliberately arose to my feet and really savored the joy of the moment. It was a rather interesting time, and I'll never forget the sense of triumph. It was really kind of a smugness that I reveled in as the chairman turned to me and said that I had the floor. And I'll never forget the groans of defeat, because the other side knew that unless they had their motion on the floor first, they were dead. You know, some people think that God is sort of like the chairman of that meeting. They think that when it comes to the doctrine of election, God is the chairman of the board, knows what people will do in advance, and therefore at the critical moment of choice, he looks out and he chooses those who are going to go his way. Now, I have to admit, that's what happened in the meeting, and it was kind of enjoyable to be on the winning side for once. But that is not the way God runs his administration. He is not like the chairman of that meeting. He does not look out or look down through the corridors of time to see who is going to vote for him, and then he chooses them on that knowledge. Some think so, but I do not think that our text will demonstrate that that can be true. Others have tried to place far more responsibility on man, and put in its crudest terms, it goes something like this. God votes for us, Satan votes against us, and we cast the deciding vote. Well, that surely cannot be held either in the light of this text. Some, however, come to the conclusion that, and rightly so, that God makes his choice totally apart from the works that we will do. But they go then to an illogical and wrong assumption that therefore it really doesn't matter what we do, if that is the case. And I would like to address that problem, because it seems to me that Genesis chapter 25 is the clearest illustration of the doctrine of election in all of the Old Testament. Paul must have thought so too. Because when it came to the doctrine of election, when it comes to the doctrine of election, the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 9 draws our attention to this event, and he believes that it is the clearest illustration of how the doctrine of election works. And so as we come knowing that it is an important portion of Scripture because the apostle himself has indicated that such is the case. Now let's take a look at verses 1 through 11 And this is the what I call Abraham's death and his descendants. It is a little bit surprising, to say the least, to find Keturah sandwiched in here at the end of Abraham's life. Now you stop and think about it. Abraham is 140 plus years old. Abraham was one who, at age 100, was described by the Apostle Paul as being as good as dead so far as producing children were concerned. Here he is 40 years later, supposedly getting married and having bunches of kids. Well, I think there is an explanation. And that is, as a number of scholars have suggested through the years, that this marriage did not occur after the death of Sarah, but before it. Now, we can say that because, first of all, in verse 1, it can easily be rendered, just as easily, I guess I should say, that Abraham had taken another wife rather than took. You will notice, if you happen to be using a New International Version, that at the bottom there is a footnote that gives evidence of that possibility. But also you will notice in 1 Chronicles chapter 1 and verse 32 that Keturah is referred to not as a wife, but as a concubine. And if you will notice in verse 6, it says, "But to the sons of his concubines," plural. Now we know that Abraham had a concubine. Her name was Hagar. But now we know that he had more than one. And it seems very logical in the light of 1 Chronicles chapter 1 that we must say that Keturah was a concubine as well. Now, there is no need for a woman to be taken as a concubine, and there is no real accuracy of a woman being taken as a concubine if there is no other wife who has, pardon me for saying so, in band terminology, first chair. That is, Sarah was the full wife. A concubine was a sort of a second-class wife. She usually came from the ranks of the slaves or the servants that were household servants, and she married up, so to speak, and she became one who had greater rights and greater privileges and freedoms, but still was not fully free. And her children were not full heirs, but they were slaves within that household. Now, if that child were released, then they were released not only from heirship or any claim on the possessions of the father, but they were given full freedom. So it seems to me that Keturah is a concubine, and therefore she was taken during the life of Sarah, and that it is mentioned here because Moses wants to indicate to us that Isaac was one of many children who could have been the heir, but it was through the doctrine of election, or should I say the principle of election. If you want to say selection, that's fine. The principle of selection surely applies. Because it was not just God choosing Isaac over Ishmael. It was God's choice of Isaac over Ishmael and Zimran and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and so on. Many possibilities, but God selected one to be the heir. All right, we can also, by the way, notice that it says that Abraham sent away these sons of his concubines. And as we have suggested in the case of Hagar and Ishmael, when a child was sent away, there was a renunciation then of any heirship that might be claimed, and in exchange for that sending away, full freedom was granted. And I understand then that these sons of Keturah were sent away as concubine sons who are given full freedom now. And amazingly enough, Abraham does not operate just within the law. All he had to do within the law was give them their freedom. But you will notice he operated by grace in that he gave them gifts as he sent them away. But all of that was in recognition on Abraham's part that not only Ishmael must be renounced as the heir, but all of the sons which came about as a result of his marriages, not only then to Sarah, but concubine marriages, to Hagar and Keturah as well. Now, that is the backdrop to the lineage, and you will see that this is a rather genealogical chapter in the sense that we begin with the most remote and distant, that is, the sons of Keturah, who we have never heard of before. Then we move to Ishmael and finally to Isaac, and we see that the process of God's working is particular, that is, he is selective as he works out his purpose and brings about his promise through particular people. Now, in verse 7, and following through verse 10, we see the death of Abraham described. He died at the age of 175 years, and that, needless to say, is a ripe old age, as Moses indicates to us, and he was gathered to his people. Notice in verse 9 that Isaac and Ishmael declare at least a temporary truce. Ishmael returns. I personally think that in the gifts that were distributed, that Ishmael was included. That may have happened after the death of Sarah, and it probably did, knowing Sarah, but that the gifts were included to Ishmael, and that there was at least some kind of a relationship that was tolerable between Isaac and Ishmael at this point in time. Of course, between their descendants, there was greater alienation. They buried him together in the cave of Machpelah, and as we suggested, when Abraham purchased that burial plot, it was an expression of his faith in God that God was going to give him the promised land of Canaan. And the burial plot was not just for Sarah, it was for Sarah and Abraham and all of the descendants of the line. You will notice that when Ishmael is buried, it does not say he was buried at the cave of Machpelah because he was not of the line who would inherit that promised land. So Abraham is buried, and I like verse 11 because what it says is, God's purpose is narrowing down to work itself out, or God's promise is going to work itself out through Isaac. Abraham is dead, but the purposes and the program of God are not. They are going to continue on through Isaac. And therefore, it says, God blessed his son Isaac, and God will continue to work through Isaac the promises that he has made to Abraham. Verses 12 through 18, then, are a description of the lineage of Ishmael, who has already been sent away, but this is a demonstration of the process of selection that has excluded Ishmael from the covenant blessings and promises that are only going to work out through Isaac. And you will notice that the promise of God has been fulfilled to Abraham, and I should have mentioned that, incidentally, in verses 1 through 11. You see, over and over, the promises of God fulfilled. You see, for example, that God had promised to make of Abraham a multitude of nations. And one of the things that is evident in this portion is that not only was the nation to come, the nation to come through Isaac, and another nation to come through Ishmael, but other nations came through Keturah. That was in fulfillment of the promise that had been made to Abraham. Also, Abraham was promised that he would have a life that was relatively free from distress and so on in Genesis chapter 15, and that he would be buried at a ripe old age. That promise was fulfilled also. Now we notice in verses 12 through 18 that other promises of God are being fulfilled to Abraham that God had made. You remember when Abraham petitioned to God and really requested that Ishmael might be the son of promise instead of Isaac, who was yet unborn, that God said to him in Genesis 17:20, "And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him, and I will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall become the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation." Therefore, it is no surprise in verse 16 of chapter 25 that it says, "These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages and by their camps, 12 princes according to their tribes." God not only made a promise to Abraham concerning Ishmael, but he also made a promise to Hagar. And that promise was that God would make of him, as we see in Genesis chapter 16 and verse 12, "He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live to the east of all his brothers." And you will notice that Abraham is said to have sent away his descendants to the east, and then you will notice that it says in verse 18, "They settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes toward Assyria, he settled in defiance of all his relatives. So in a sense, you can see as we're going down through this portion of Scripture that deals with the quote-unquote non-elect. And I mean by that, not necessarily unsaved or unbelievers, but non-elect so far as those who were selected to carry out the line that would bring about the promised Messiah and the blessings which God had assured Abraham would be brought forth. So these are the non-elect, and you might say, of all of those promises, paid in full. Every promise God made concerning those people was fulfilled according to the Word of God. Now, the real selection that takes place occurs in verses 19 and following. If God has evidenced, and I think He has, and Moses, I think, is underscoring this in these genealogies, that God works selectively. That is, that God was to bring about a child from Abraham, not through Keturah, not through Hagar, but through Sarah, who was unable to bear children and who bore this child at an impossible age. And God was not going to bring about His promises through Ishmael or through Zimram, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, and so on, but through Isaac. The process of selection is clear. But what we see in verses 19 and following is that selection is also a selection that occurs within the womb between two twins who are the descendants of one person, Isaac. And there has to be a distinction at this point. If the line is always to continue through one man, there must be a distinction then even between twins who are in the womb. So the principle of election is demonstrated even to that point, and Paul underscores that in Romans chapter 9. So he marries Isaac marries Rebekah at the age of 40. You will notice that the child is born at the age of 60. If I count right, and if modern math hasn't changed too many things, that means that there were 20 years of waiting for a child. And in that period of waiting, then Isaac petitioned the Lord on behalf of his wife, and God answered the prayer. Again, God often works in the life of His people through delays, and it is those delays which inspire faith on the part of the true believer. Now, notice what happens. Even during the pregnancy, something unusual is evidenced, and God signals that there is something dramatic that is going to take place in this birth, even before it occurs. Now, my wife has had 6 children, and I have witnessed all of that, at least to some extent. And I remember that the first child is always the biggest thrill. You want to feel the baby when it kicks and as it moves around. And I am sure that the mother on the first child is always much more concerned about little things than she is when it gets to number 5 or 6 or so on. And I would imagine that Rebecca was very interested in what was taking place in her womb. But as she talked to the other women who had gone through this, and perhaps the midwives and whoever was available to discuss it with, she learned that what was happening within her was extraordinary. That is, she had an unusual amount of activity within her womb. And so she sees this as some signal, perhaps, that there was a special significance to what was happening within her. Notice that it says that the children struggle within her, and she went to inquire of the Lord. This is one of those passages where if our curiosity were going to be satisfied, much more would have been said. That's an expression which later on in the Old Testament usually was used in a more technical way of consulting God and in a more official way to go to the priest or so on. But this is before that whole system has been set up. It is possible that she may have gone to Abraham, who was still alive until the kids were about 15. It is possible that she actually went to Abraham and asked him, because Abraham was a prophet. I do not know. But in some way, I think more dramatic than simply asking in prayer, she inquired of God, and God's answer is given to her in verse 23. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two people shall be separated from your body, and one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." That is a tremendously significant revelation from God to Rebekah. He is saying, first of all, in answer to your question, you know you're pregnant, But without a sonogram or any of the other devices which people use, God says to her, you're going to have twins. Now that ought to be rather obvious, because she has two nations represented in her womb. And two people shall be separated from your body. Then you will notice that it goes on to say that of these twins, there is going to be two separate nations, two peoples, very different from one another. And it would be suggested and implied from the tumult and the strife within her that there was a hostility that was taking place. Can you believe that, being a mother of twins and having those kids fighting inside the womb? That's what was going on. And it says, of these two nations, one of them will be predominant. It will have a greatness that surpasses the other. And one shall be stronger than the other. Notice it says one people shall be stronger than the other, not necessarily that Jacob himself was stronger than Esau, but those who would come out from him would be the predominant, prevailing people. Now, all of that was revelation, but it could be within the norm of what might be expected. But the last statement that is made is that which violates or goes contrary to the natural order of things, and that is where God says, and the older shall serve the younger. And it is here that the natural order is reversed, and God takes that second-born child and makes that child the one who is the heir, who possesses the birthright. Now, obviously, it would have been no problem for a sovereign God to have arranged the birth process so that Jacob would have come out first. But what God is evidencing is that he is not bound to work in conventional means and to do that which is expected and predictable and customary. God is sovereign, and he may choose to overrule our customs and our traditions. And so he does here. Now, notice that there are some events that take place during the birth which tend to confirm the prophecy that has already occurred before the birth. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. Edom means red, and it really comes more, although it is suggested here, it comes more from the stew, that red stuff. That is where the name Edom was attached to him, and the Edomites, of course, then become his offspring. But he was hairy all over. Now, in some cultures, and I suspect it must have been so in that one, that hair on your chest was a sign of manhood. And this boy was obviously going to be a he-man. He was a hairy little rascal. And that was a symbolic evidence of what he would be, macho, masculine, and so on. Then Jacob reveals his character in the birth process. As he comes forth, he is grasping to the heel of Esau. And in that, now I'm sure that at the very moment they did not understand the significance of that, but as they looked back upon it, they did. And you will notice that his name, Jacob, then comes from the name heel. And they did see significance, although they didn't understand the significance. They recognized that that was somehow significant about his character, and surely later days would bear that out. Now, that is the unusual backdrop, both before the birth and during the birth. But I want you to notice some factors which I think are absolutely crucial so far as the things which divided these two boys from each other. I understand that there are three very significant factors that occur which divide the two. First of all, there is the matter of different dispositions. When these boys grow up, it is very obvious, and as our children grow up, it doesn't take long at all to know that each child has a particular disposition. And the two dispositions are very different. Esau was the athletic type. The hairy little boy, infant, was a hairy-chested kind of young man that a father would be proud of. I think that, frankly, he was a kind of aggressive, assertive, a little flamboyant in his disposition. He was the kind of boy that probably played on the football team and probably did well. And the kind of young man that made Isaac's chest just stick out. As Isaac went out about his work and perhaps interacted with the other men, there's little doubt which son he would have taken with him. He was proud of that boy. He was an outdoorsman, really loved to get out, and when he went out and hunted, he didn't come back empty-handed. He was a man's man. Now, I think Rebecca would have viewed him just a little differently. Probably if you had given her one word to characterize Esau, it would have been the word crude. And incidentally, if you had given Isaac one word to characterize his son Jacob, it would have been sissy, mama's boy. Because Jacob was the more quiet type. He liked to stay around home. I suspect that his disposition was such that he didn't always say what he was thinking. But basically, Jacob was the kind of boy who, as he observed his older brother, decided that perhaps in life it was possible to get ahead without having dirt and grease under your fingernails. And that maybe that wasn't such a desirable lifestyle after all. Maybe he watched his brother go out in the fields and get sweaty and smelly for one lousy rabbit, and he says to himself, there's got to be a better way to get ahead. And there was. Well, those are the two boys and their different dispositions. Only our imaginations can run as far as probably the actual situation went. Then there were divided loyalties. Not only did these two boys have very different dispositions, but the fact was their parents were divided as to how they felt about them. Now, it's no surprise that Isaac would have favored Esau. It's no surprise at all. He was the kind of son that a father would have been proud of. And do you notice it says that Isaac had a taste for game? Esau was just his kind of boy. He loved wild game. Now, I think that Jacob could have bartered anybody out of wild game. But there was something of greater satisfaction to eat meat that his son had brought in. He loved that boy. And it says, Rebekah loved Jacob. Well, you can imagine if he was a boy that was more sensitive, more cultured and refined, that would be the case. She would be repulsed by Esau. But as much as this is a fact of life, and as much as it is a fact of life today, my friends, it's wrong. And I think it's very evident that the favoritism that is demonstrated to those boys was partly what was responsible for the alienation of those two boys, and I might add, the alienation of the parents as well. When the mother finally gets to the point where she's willing to scheme to deceive her own husband so that her son could get ahead, that's devastating. Then there were the deceitful dealings. Different dispositions, divided loyalties between the parents, and deceitful dealings. And that is what we see in verses 27 and following. Here is an event which no doubt drove the wedge within the crack and divided these boys and laid the groundwork for future hatred and alienation between them. It's really kind of an interesting story. You'll notice, again, Esau was the skillful hunter, and apparently he had been out in the field. What the boys were doing at this point is a sort of a reflection of their dispositions. Esau had been out. Apparently, it was either hot or cold, whatever it was. The elements must have worn him down. Believe me, he was not at death's door, as he suggested. But he was tired, and he was hungry. So he comes in from the field, and Jacob has been doing what he always did best. He was working at the stove, cooking up a good meal, and apparently it was great. And Esau comes in and asks for some of that. And you have to understand that Esau almost blubbered. And that was the thing that probably made his mother think he was a slob. I mean, he would come in and he'd say, let me have some of that red stuff there. And it's hard to convey the crudeness that is suggested by the Hebrew text. But he almost blubbers over himself, slobbers over this food. And you can see how his mother would say, yuck. That's the kind of boy he was. So he comes in, and you will notice, if lest we think that Jacob was the wonderful fellow that he was, Jacob's disposition becomes rather clear too. See, Jacob's grandfather, Abraham, was a man of hospitality. He was a man who, when he saw three strangers on their way by his house, ran out in the heat of the day, begged them to stay, and put a banquet before them. What does Jacob do? Well, Jacob, as he hears his brother whimpering and whining for food, the old dollar signs begin to ring up in his eyes, and his computer's going, just whizzing away inside, and he says, hey, here is a chance to get ahead. Here is my golden opportunity, not my opportunity to demonstrate hospitality, let alone love for a brother. Here is my opportunity to get the edge on Esau. And so that is his approach. And he says, first, sell me your birthright. I don't think that was some instantaneous thought that just popped into his mind. I personally think that Jacob had set that up as the goal of his life, was to edge out his brother so far as the birthright was concerned. It's obvious that Esau had no appreciation for it. It seems to me also obvious that Jacob had a great appreciation for it, and he was willing to do anything, literally anything, to get it. So he says, first sell me your birthright. Verse 32, again, Esau's character is manifest. He says, behold, I'm about to die, so of what use is the birthright to me? You know, we look at that and we say, he was a slob. And yet, we look at our television sets and we hear the macho men of our day saying, you only go around once, so grab all the gusto you can get. You see, it's a matter of placing present physical desires above destiny, eternal destiny. It is saying, now is the only time, the now generation. I want it for me now, my appetites, my satisfaction. If it feels good, do it. If it tastes good, eat it. That's what he's saying. What good is a birthright? I'm hungry. And he's willing to exchange his destiny for a dinner. And that is what the writer to the Hebrews says. Well, Jacob is going to make sure that he has clinched it. And so he says, first, swear to me. In other words, he is saying, in effect, he is swearing him to a solemn oath. He's saying, I just happen to have a contract here, and if you would write down here in the fine print, if you would just sign right there, I'll have it notarized, and that'll take care of it. This guy's a businessman. It won't stop. He's going to cinch the deal. And you will notice then, verse 34, then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank, and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. That to me is one of the most tragic statements in all the book of Genesis. And it is seconded by the writer to the Hebrews, who says in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 16, let's start at verse 15, see to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled, that there be no immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. Here was a man who had no appreciation for spiritual things. Now, isn't that an interesting way to end? As the Apostle Paul turns us back to this event, he teaches us some vital lessons about the doctrine of election. He says that the doctrine of election is certainly not that process whereby God looks down through the corridors of time like a man trying to bet on a horse at a horse race, and he gets some inside information from his omniscience. And he says, there's one that'll choose me, I'll take him. There's another, I'll take her. But Paul says that the process of election, and incidentally, let me say, I do not think this is election to damnation or salvation here. It is election so far as the person is concerned through whom the promises made to Abraham will be realized. Now, in Romans chapter 9, it is election unto salvation. But Paul is simply demonstrating the principle of election that is far broader than just salvation. So Paul says the election process is one that does not take into account the works of the one who is going to be chosen. And therefore, Paul says, by bringing us back here, the choice was made before the children were born. And we know that's true. God indicated in verse 23 that the older would serve the younger before either were born. And it is a process whereby God sets aside the traditions and the trends of the day, and he overrules them. The older will serve the younger. That was not traditional. It was not cultural. It was not expected. But it is what happened. Then Paul goes on to say that it was a process that totally excluded what either party would do. I think many people look at Jacob and they think, boy, he was a neat guy. He was really the guy I would have chosen too. I don't think I would have. I've got to be honest. If I had to choose which guy I would spend time with, I'd have gone with Esau any day. Some of you probably say, yeah, I know. That's right. Birds of a feather. Well, I do not see in Jacob's character anything that was much more commendable than that which was in Esau's. But notice what the Apostle Paul says. He says, and not only this, Romans chapter 9, verse 10, but there was Rebekah also when she had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac, for though the twins were not yet born and had not done anything, good or bad, in order that God's purpose according to his choice might stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls. Now it is obvious that God in his omniscience knows from eternity past what all of us will do. But the point that is made here is that God chose these boys, one of the boys, before they were born and disregarded what he knew about them so that his choice was not based upon works. And the reason is this, my friend. If I understand Scripture correctly and God were to look down through the corridor of time and choose only those who would choose him, he would choose no one at all. Because we are by nature children of wrath. There's nobody to choose. That's why God's salvation must be totally devoid of works, because no one is worthy of it. No one will ever prove worthy of it. Now, having said that, and I have to stress that to get where I'm going now, I learned a very interesting lesson about the non-elect. Many people are not so troubled about the elect as they are about the rest. And we're inclined, and believe me, there are passages of Scripture which clearly indicate that the destiny of the non-elect is a part of the sovereign decree of God. Do not misunderstand me on that point. But I want you to notice the emphasis of the Scriptures. It says, thus Esau despised his birthright. Not thus God despised Esau, but Esau despised God. That is the thrust. The reason why Esau is rejected is because he rejected. And that needs to be our emphasis. I read a very, very interesting statement, which I want to share with you, by Dr. B.B. Warfield on the subject of election. I have never heard it said as well, and that is why I'm going to read it to you. This man, folks, is a Calvinist. But listen to what he says about election. He draws a picture. And he says that the calling forth of Lazarus out of the tomb is an illustration of divine election, not only in terms of who is saved, but of who is lost. Listen to this. When Christ stood at the door of Lazarus' tomb and cried, Lazarus, come forth, only Lazarus of all the dead that lay there in the gloom of the grave that day in Palestine or throughout the world heard his mighty voice which raises the dead and came forth. What it's saying is this. If Jesus had not said, Lazarus, come forth, all of them would have come forth. That's election. Okay? Shall we say that the election of Lazarus to be called forth from the tomb consigned all this immense multitude of the dead to hopeless physical decay? It left them, no doubt, in the death in which they were holden and to all that comes out of this death. But it was not it which brought death upon them,
or which kept them in its power. When God calls out of the human race, lying dead in their trespasses and sins, some here, some there, some everywhere, a great multitude which no man can number, to raise them by His almighty grace out of their death in sin and bring them to glory, His electing grace is glorified in the salvation it works. It has nothing to do with the death of the sinner, but only with the living again of the sinner whom it calls into life. The one and the single work of election is salvation. Now that, to me, is a biblical, a biblical attitude toward election. I have had a bad illustration, which I have chosen to scrap now in the light of what I have seen from this passage. People have said to me, "Do you believe in double predestination?" I have to say, "Yes, I guess I do." All those who are appointed to salvation are the elect, and surely if God is able to save all and hasn't, then God has made a choice not to save. That, I think, is biblical truth. But I used to use an illustration. I used to say, if there were a ship that sank, and God had a lifeboat that was big enough to take all the survivors on board, and He didn't, is God therefore not responsible for those He didn't save as well as those that He did? And that sounds like a terrific illustration. You know what the problem is? All the people who are swimming around out there in that water sank the ship. They're responsible for being out there. All the people who are dead in their trespasses and sins are there because they have rejected God. And when God chooses not to choose them, He chooses to leave them in the destruction that they have chosen for themselves. That puts election into perspective. Now, if I can calm down long enough, let me say a couple of things. The misuse of the doctrine of election. There are two misuses of it here that I want to leave with you. One of them is the misuse of Jacob. Jacob misused or responded wrongly to the doctrine of election because he tried to change it. He did. He tried to outdo God and to manipulate God into blessing Esau rather than Jacob. Just like Abraham wanted God to make Ishmael the heir rather than Isaac. That's wrong, friends. You must recognize that God is sovereign, and we must acknowledge His working in the world today. You know what one of the last incidents is in the life of Jacob, who wanted to change God's elective processes? He was now Israel, but he had the two sons of Joseph. And you remember Joseph, his dad was so old he could hardly see straight, and he set the sons up, and he set the oldest son at the right hand of Jacob, and the youngest son at his left hand. And I tell you, the old boy may have been old, but he wasn't that old. He crossed his hands. And his father said, or his son, Joseph said, "Dad, you got it wrong." And Jacob said, "No, I don't." You know what he was evidencing? That God has the right to choose. And we do not have the right to challenge it. Second, the misuse of the doctrine of election is demonstrated by Rebekah. She used the prophecy of God to justify, I believe, to justify her favoritism of her son. And that was just as wrong. I am amazed at how often we go to Scripture to justify what we want done. It doesn't make the Scriptures any less true. It simply means we are twisting them to our ends, and that is wrong. Now, lest we think that is only something that Rebekah did, let me raise this parting question. God in prophecy has evidenced to us that His elective purposes are going to culminate in the nation Israel. Right? I would suggest that we are as wrong to favor Israel over the Arab world as Rebekah was to favor Jacob over Esau. I have seen Christians literally slobbering over themselves to show partiality to Jews. I am not saying we ought to discriminate. I am saying we ought to stop discriminating for Jews and against Arabs. That is not justified just because God is going to bring about His blessing. Let me tell you,
that what the Jews are doing in unbelief is as reprehensible as what Jacob did in unbelief. And we ought not to justify sinful behavior on anybody's part. It's amazing how the American press can call something an act of retaliation and the other as an act of aggression, depending on whether you're Jewish or Arab. Let's be careful, folks. I think we are getting into trouble in showing favoritism by a misuse. And the reason why we favor Israel, the reason why I favor Israel, is because they've got guts. And in the world that we live in, it's great to see somebody who can shake their fist in the face of public opinion and say, get lost. That's why I favor them, not because they're...